This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Thursday, December the 13th. I'm Angela Denning. Petersburg School Board approved a $1.47 million contract for renovating the kitchen at the elementary school and building the first ever kitchen at the middle and high school. The unanimous vote of support came at a board meeting Tuesday night. The school board approved the contract bid for J. Brand General Contractors out of Homer, Alaska. The renovation project has been years in the coming.
It's going to happen. We talked about this last night. I said it's been how many years of talking about this?
Superintendent Erica Kluepainter.
It has been signed. It is all in the right places. They cannot freeze us out again.
6 years ago, the school district was approved for state funding for the project, but it was pulled along with other capital projects during the state's fiscal crisis. Then, on its own, the school district started doing prep work for a kitchen in the middle and high school. Last year, the district got the word that state funding was now coming through. Since the amount had been frozen, it doesn't account for inflation. So, the district is pitching in $300,000, which the board also approved at its meeting. That's money that the district already has, which was set aside for projects like this. And the project plan has been pared down a little. Some of the work can be done in-house, and Kluepainter says they're asking the contractor to work wisely.
Reusing flooring that's only 4 or 5 years old, reworking any materials that can be reused.
It will be the first kitchen ever at the middle and high school. It will be a modified catering kitchen, not a commercial one. The school's lunches can be prepared there, and it can be used to cook foods for extracurricular activities. The kitchen at the grade school will see major upgrades. For years, it's been an open floor plan, with nothing dividing the cooks working in the kitchen from the students at the lunch tables. The new kitchen will create a larger space with an enclosed cooking area. Kluepainter says the space could also serve other purposes.
One of the needs that happens in the elementary school is there's no place really in the building to have all of the kids at once. Usually you have to truck them over to the auditorium, which is great. We have this beautiful auditorium, and that's nice for, you know, bigger events, but it's 15, 20 minutes every time you transition kids. So there will be space in that cafeteria.
Even with the modified plans, the renovation is still something to celebrate, says school board president Marla Tomsky.
It's just time that we settle these lunchrooms and allow both facilities to have a good space for our kids to eat and a place where they can have food prepared and the state stops walking through and saying, hey, you need to have this, you need to have this. You know, it's time.
The renovation project could start in the spring, before school is out, but most of the work will likely happen in the summer months. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning. Metlakatla Indian Community held a special election Tuesday, and the results mean big changes. Residents of the island community just south of Ketchikan voted to follow Alaska Standard Time and to allow liquor sales on their island. Layla Carey has more from Ketchikan.
Every year in the fall, daylight saving time ends in Alaska, most of Alaska. In Metlakatla, the time doesn't change, and for about half the year, the state's only native reserve is an hour earlier than the rest of Alaska. Next year, though, Metlakatla will fall back with everyone else. Residents of Annette Island voted by a wide margin to follow Alaska Standard Time. Carl Cook is mayor of Metlakatla Indian Community. He says way back in the 1980s, when most of Alaska consolidated its four time zones into one, Metlakatla residents took a vote.
And we decided to keep our time, our local community time, the same year-round. And the community voted on it at that point as a whole. And in order to change that, we had to have another community-wide vote.
Cook says the new election results show that most Metlakatla residents want to conform to the rest of the state, at least when it comes to the time.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to maintain our time until they spring forward, and then we'll align with the state at that time, and from then on, I think we'll stay with the state.
So for now, you guys will continue to be an hour ahead?
Well, let's see. I got 10 o'clock now, so yeah.
Okay, yeah, an hour ahead. It's about 9 here.
Yeah.
And that's the argument in favor of changing. Metlakatla is a quick ferry ride from Ketchikan. Residents cross back and forth, often for shopping, health care, or to attend events. The time difference can get confusing. But Cook says he prefers it the way it has been.
Because the kids, when they get out of school, they can go home during daylight, you know, and when if we switch back, then it's dark both times, whether they're going to school or whether they're coming home from school.
He was in the minority, though. According to ballot results, 295 voted in favor of the time change, and 162 voted against. The ballot results show 302 residents voted in favor of a community-owned liquor store, with 152 voting no. Cook says MIC officials will have to figure out how to get a liquor license and open up a store. He says he wasn't much involved in that issue, but some MIC council members have a plan to move forward.
The people have spoken, you know, and so we're going to have to do some catch-up and see where we're at on it and how best to proceed.
Metlakatla used to be a dry community, Cook says, but in more recent years has allowed residents to purchase a limited amount of alcohol elsewhere and bring it to Annette Island. Cook says he's a non-drinker, and that issue, too, was something he would have preferred to not change.
No, actually, I voted no on both, and we got myself beat pretty bad.
But he says that's how elections work, and Metlakatla will move forward with what the majority of voters approved. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The state's Board of Game meets in Petersburg next month to decide on proposed changes to hunting and trapping regulations for Southeast. Among the proposed changes is one to expand the area for an archery deer hunt behind Petersburg. The local Fish and Game Advisory Committee supported the proposal at a meeting this month, but recommended a change because of safety concerns. Joe Vicknicki has more.
The proposal pertains to what's called the Petersburg Management Area, just south and east of downtown and the airport. Currently, hunters have to be at least a quarter mile from the airport property or any homes, businesses, or roads. Archer Dan McMahon is seeking to reduce that buffer to 100 yards.
The whole purpose of the original hunt, when it came around in the early 2000s, was to use archers as a management tool to keep the deer population down in town. And we take some deer every year, I think there's probably a few more deer that could be taken legally by certified archers.
McMahon told the advisory committee he requested information from the police department, which reported having to kill about 20 to 25 deer each year injured by vehicles on the island. Fish and Game staff are neutral on the proposal and say there's no biological concern with an increasing deer population on Mitkoff Island and only a small increase in harvest expected with the change. The local group Devil's Thumb Archers requested the special hunt and it was approved by the board in 2002. The season runs from October 15th through December 15th and has a 2-buck bag limit. The hunting area includes the hillside behind the airport and Raven's Roost and also out to Frederick Point. Hunters have to complete an archery class before participating. Committee member David Bennett's liked the idea of an expanded area.
I've hunted in this local hunt. And if you want to hunt where there's some deer, like up by the dump and stuff, it's hard to get a quarter mile from any trail or road and stuff. So I support this. I think it's a great idea. Because that was the whole idea with the deer reduction program. But the quarter mile limit, when you get out there with a GPS and start looking around, it's very hard to be legal. So I don't even try it. I haven't hunted for years.
There was some concern about the proposed 100-yard buffer around trails and roads. Here's committee member Jerry Dahl.
I mean, I'm just saying, if I'm walking down a trail and you're 100 yards away from me, are you going to hit me?
Dahl said he supported the change but was asking for safety's sake. McMahon said generally bow hunters are shooting about 20 to 30 yards and aren't very accurate beyond that range. And wildlife trooper Cody Litster wasn't concerned with the 100-yard range for bow hunters.
It would take someone pretty callous to take some half-witted shot at a 45-degree angle to get much more than your 100 yards. So that part, the state doesn't have an issue with. what it will open up is some donut hole sort of areas, like Frederick Point, the Hungry Point Trail, some of the places between behind, just back off of Sandy Beach, places where there's trails that maybe a hunter stalking a deer wouldn't know about. So I would have concerns, the state would have concerns about those areas.
The committee voted unanimously to support the proposal, but recommended leaving out any of the area inside the airport loop on the downtown side of Haugen Drive and Sandy Beach. Proposal 53 is the last in the proposal book to be considered by the board when it meets in January. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
And we'll have more coverage of the committee's discussion on proposed hunting changes coming up later this month on Local News. The Catholic Church's historic archives in Southeast Alaska will be opened up to an independent panel investigating sexual abuse by clergy. A commission of two former judges and a retired police detective will have unfettered access to personnel files. Diocese of Juneau spokesman Dominique Johnson says the files go back to 1951 when the diocese was established.
We just want to bring everything to light and be transparent. That's why we put the commission together, to review these files so that they will know, as well as us, if there were any allegations against any ministers or people who have worked on behalf of the diocese.
The three-person commission will be retired Superior Court judges Patricia Collins and Thomas Schultz and former Juneau Police Lieutenant Chris Sell. They'll begin work January 7th. Credible evidence found of perpetrators of abuse will be forwarded to the bishop and the existing review board for the protection of children.
From there, we will publish that list of names for the public to see.
That's expected to happen in June. The Juneau Bishop's decree follows a similar move by the Catholic Archdiocese in Anchorage, which appointed its own independent panel in October. Both say the move was triggered by patterns of abuse by priests uncovered at churches across the country. The Diocese of Fairbanks filed for bankruptcy 10 years ago after agreeing to pay $9.8 million in settlements to around 300 victims. The Juneau Diocese has about 10,000 parishioners under its jurisdictions, making it the smallest in the nation. It oversees Catholic churches and shrines from Yakutat to Ketchikan. Tiny homes could be a solution for affordable housing shortages, but there are hurdles in the form of regulations. Opportunities and challenges were discussed during a forum in Ketchikan last month. Residents gathered to discuss the idea of bringing tiny homes to Alaska's first city. Maria Dudzak has more.
Charlie Arnson, a realtor and member of the Borough Planning Commission, introduced discussion topics and asked attendees to work in small groups to come up with ideas for addressing them.
But we want to specifically be talking about tiny homes because I hear from the public, and we have a couple other professionals in various different industries here tonight that have also heard, that this could potentially be a solution to some of our problems.
The groups discussed benefits and drawbacks of tiny homes, problems people are trying to solve with tiny homes, and perceived challenges. Arnson asked the groups to share. They mentioned economic benefits, a possible solution to homelessness, and lower starting costs than traditional homes. Arnson believes tiny homes can provide solutions to more than just affordable housing problems.
We have an aging population that doesn't have anywhere to necessarily go. If they don't want to live in a 2,000 or 2,500 square foot house, and so if they just want to downsize even, it seems like there's some challenges to doing that.
Arnson also says affordable small homes could help students wanting to return to Ketchikan.
I know many people that I graduated with, they feel like they can't come back because either the housing is too expensive, if they can work remotely, you know, maybe they have jobs that we don't necessarily have here in Ketchikan, but for them to come back and work remotely is still not cost-effective for them.
Drawbacks pointed out included infrastructure needs and the ability to access water and utilities. Aletha Johnson, assistant borough planner, discussed zoning codes and regulations. She says zoning code applies everywhere in the borough, and additional regulations apply within Ketchikan city limits. Special regulations may also apply in the city of Saxman.
The city of Ketchikan has building code and fire code, and so there's another layer of regulations within those municipalities. And my part of the presentation applies to all properties within the borough.
Johnson says zones that could permit tiny homes include low-density residential unrestricted, general commercial, and future development. Johnson says it's best to check with borough planning to find out what can or cannot be built on a particular lot. Also, she says, there are additional restrictions under current code, such as the maximum number of residential units allowed on a lot, requirements for spacing or shared walls, and the need for a conditional use permit to build a tiny home in some zones. Matt Elbertson, a City of Ketchikan building official, discussed additional requirements if a tiny home is within city limits. He says all homes in the city must be on a permanent foundation, have services such as sewer and water, and meet other building and fire codes. Nicole Anderson of Davies Berry Insurance discussed the challenges of insuring tiny homes.
Insurance doesn't like crazy out there. We like the standard, the normal. And so with this tiny home movement, a lot of insurance carriers are trying to work around it.
She says tiny homes can be insured with certain requirements. They must be built by a manufacturer or dealer and placed on a permanent foundation. The November meeting was just the beginning of Ketchikan's tiny home discussion. Organizers hope to schedule more forums. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
And I'm Angela Denning. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine.